Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 13th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Way to Live, Christian Practices for Teens and Others. Presented by Dorothy Bass and Friends. The tape number is BAD 2002-01. Let's listen in.
Sharing with you an altogether unique project that a number of us have been involved in for the last several years. It's a project where some 20 adults and 20 teenagers have met periodically and reflected through the year on nothing short of a way to live in this world. We are looking for ways of navigating this world of ours that give life, that help us stay in our center, that help us nurture our hopes in the world. And we have discovered that we have our own yearnings in the midst of our lives to find a way of life that really does give rise to life. In our worlds, it's difficult to experience that. We feel ourselves pressured throughout the day. We get up early, we try to spend all this time to make ourselves look cool or look good, spend all these hours through the day doing activities that don't really give us meaning, whether it be work, whether it be school. We're rushing off to practices, trying to get in a little bit of exercise here and there, getting our meals through fast food, and yearning throughout it all for a little bit of peace, a little bit of stillness, a little bit of quality time with the people we care for, some hope to be nurtured, and we don't experience it very often in our ordinary lives. But every once in a while, we get a glimpse of it. Some people get a glimpse of it here at Holden. One of our teenagers, Martha, went on a mission trip, and she got a glimpse of it there for a week. It was a week where everything that we did, the meals we shared, the work we did, the prayers we prayed together, the play, all of it gelled into a whole. It was like everything flowed together. And she said it was kind of like a dance. It was like all the movements of our life flowed to rhythms that healed, gave rise to life. It was as if they were moving to a beat, that beat at the deep center of the world. Most of our lives we experience don't feel like a dance. They feel wooden, stale, and deadening. But in the midst of it all, there is an invitation for a dance that gives rise to life. Tell a little story. When my son Justin was about 4 years old, we found ourselves navigating and stumbling through this world in a rather cramped confines of a one-bedroom apartment. We were sharing a bedroom, we were sharing the living room, the kitchen table had to work as a PlayStation for Legos and workstation for me. We were doing pretty good though, until some of our closest friends, a family of four, moved from Seattle to Southern California. And right before the beginning of school, they said, we have a house that's gonna open in just one day, could we just spend the night in your apartment? Well, that seemed to be fine enough, except that one day turned into two into three into four into a week, 1 week into 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a solid month. Six of us are sharing this one-bedroom apartment, and even the closest of friendships can be tried in that kind of a setting. Believe me. And I think Justin had the worst of it. I mean, he was the one who had to share his dad. He had to share his toys. He had to sleep on the floor with me in the living room. He was doing pretty good, though, until one day, he just had it. I'm sitting on the couch with the mother of my friend, and we're talking, and we have a sliding glass door, and out behind it, there's this big mound of dirt where every kid in the apartment complex congregates. And they dig for gold, they dig to go to China, they climb Mount Everest, they're doing all of these things, and there's Justin, he's got a shovel, and he's this budding paleontologist, and he's digging out this boulder, but it's really a jawbone of a T-Rex. And he's digging this thing out when this kid walks over and just grabs the shovel out of Justin's hands and starts digging someplace else. Well, Justin looks at him, he goes over, he grabs a shovel back, he starts digging on his jawbone. Well, this kid is undaunted. He goes over, grabs the shovel, yanks on it, Justin yanks back and forth until he pulls it out of his hands, Justin falls on his knees, and he goes walking away. Well, Justin looks at this kid with a look that could kill. He gets up, stomps the ground, He walks down the hill. He slams open the sliding glass door, slams it shut, walks into the living room, gets into the corner, sits into his little rocking chair, and he pouts. I said, Justin, what's the matter? He said, I am mad. I am never playing with my friends ever again in my entire life. Well, I could identify with that feeling right about then. That's okay. You could just sit in a chair, and he just pouted. I started talking to this friend again, and we just let him be. Well, my godson, who's also 4 years old, he's playing Legos on the kitchen, on the living room table, oblivious to everything that's going on. And while he's playing Legos and I'm talking, the radio goes from a commercial break, and all of a sudden, this music comes out of the stereo and starts to filter through the room. It's a Kenny G saxophone solo. No Kenny G? And it's one of these melodies that just kind of works its way around you, you know, and it just kind of soaks inside of you. And before long, you just kind of find yourself moving your shoulders a little bit, and you're tapping your toe a little bit. You're kind of moving your hips a little bit. And little Jackson, he's getting into this music. He's playing his Legos, but he's just starting to move. And before long, he can't help it anymore. He gets up off of the table, and he starts just dancing right in the middle of the living room, all by himself. He's just having a ball to Kenny G. And we're looking at him, and Justin's in the corner looking at him, and he's just dancing, and Jackson says, hey, Justin, do you want to dance with me? And Justin's like, well, okay. He gets up off the chair, and he starts dancing with Jackson. And for the two of them, they spend several minutes just going to the music. I mean, they're doing a little do-si-do and promenading, a little twirling, a little John Travolta action. They're having a ball just lifted up into this glory. It's like the ceiling had given way. The sun was shining on them. They're smiling. They're giggling. They're having a ball in the life of this dance. And then after the music is over, and its spirit, its melody, lingers in the air, Jackson looks at Justin and says, you want to go out and dig for dinosaur bones? And Justin goes, yeah, let's go. And the two of them start running out the backyard. And I go, Justin, wait a minute. Where are you going? I say, he says, I'm going to play with my friends. I go, play with your friends? I thought you were never going to play with them ever again in your entire life. He looked at me like, what are you talking about? And then he remembered, like it was a lifetime ago. He says, oh yeah. You know, Dad, I think the dancing took my mad away. And he went outside and played with his friends. We believe that there is a deep music that plays through the heart of creation. That even in the midst of the cacophony of our activities, when we're the ones scurrying to dig bones out of the soil, when we're the ones that are pouting in the corner, when we're the ones that are pulling our own agenda out of the hands of everybody else, even in the midst of all of that, there's a music that plays through it all. And that music invites us to move to its rhythm, to catch its beat, to walk the steps that it lays out for us. And it comes with a promise that as we move in these ways, as we participate in this dance, we will be taken up into a life that brings flourishing, that nurtures our hope, that does take away the mad in our lives. Dorothy Bass and Don Richter, 3 years ago, invited some 20 adults and 20 teens to North Carolina and asked us to explore together, in the midst of all of the ordinariness of our life, where is that beat? Where might we find ways of moving that will lift us up into rhythms that bring life? Where can we find a way to live? And we believe that we found some things in a place that goes all the way back through our tradition. Our tradition gives us practices, dance steps, ways of moving that we can practice in the midst of the ordinariness of our lives with the hope and the promise that they will bring this life. All of us gathered in North Carolina. We started with a drum circle. And we were all, you can imagine, 20 teens, 20 adults, none of us who knew each other, just kind of looking, scoping each other out, not sure if these teens are going to be unruly, not sure if the adults are going to be unruly, not sure if these are people we can trust, right? And we started pounding on the drum. And after a while, in the pounding, we kind of discovered a beat that united us. And we all started moving to that beat until we all participated in this flow. For 3 years, we have explored different practices, different ways of being in the midst of our daily lives. And each adult and each teen partnered together to explore one segment of life and to explore the kind of practice that might nurture hope, fullness, healing in the midst of that one segment of life. And in the end, we came up with a book. And the book just came out 1 week ago, Way to Live. And this is a book of 18 practices that we've all been exploring. And what we would like to do today is share with you some of the dance steps, some of the glimpses that we've had as we stumble our own way through this life of ours that have given us some life, some dance steps that we struggled with, some places we stumbled hard, but yet still found some things that promise a way of being that gives life to us and we hope to others. What we're going to do is each of these persons are going to do like a little book reading, little poetry reading. I'm just going to read you one segment from the different chapters. Each person has picked that part of that chapter that is the heartbeat that speaks to them most fully. And after we've done that, then we'd like to invite you all to ask questions or offer your own insights and talk about what is it like for teens and adults to find a way to live in the midst of this world. So our first chapter, our very introductory chapter, is called something very manageable, life. Martha wrote the introduction to this chapter, the synopsis. I want a way to live that keeps me involved in what God is doing in me and in the world around me. Do you know a way to live that is like that?
My name is Dorothy Bass. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, and I wrote this chapter with my children, Martha Schwing and John Schwing, and I'll read you a section. You don't have to be a teenager to experience a deep desire to live in a way that is deeply, truly good. But the teenage years are a great time to let the desire surface, a great time to think about what a good life would be like and to speak your hopes out loud. You're making choices today that will affect all your tomorrows. And besides, how you live matters right now. Life is not only something that lies ahead of you after high school. You have talents and passions today. You have heart and mind and soul and strength today. You have the ability to help or to hurt other people and the earth today. You do have the option of not thinking about how you live, of course. You could just go with the flow. Sit back and let other people tell you what to think and do. Some of the people who'd be glad to tell you are obvious. Certain teachers, maybe your parents, even some of your friends. Others are not so obvious, like the merchants of cool, marketers who want your deepest desires to be for the things they sell, from clothes and makeup to CDs and cars. They'd like to cover your body with advertisements and clutter your mind with images of a good life that's pretty different from the one we think you deserve. Their good life is about great vacations, glamorous clothes, and the hottest cars. Things few people possess and not what life is really about anyway. This book invites you into a community of people who don't just go with the flow. This community's image of the good life is not about having lots of stuff or being more successful than other people. Instead, it's about getting involved in the loving, challenging life of God. this community first gathered around Jesus. When Jesus healed the sick, invited himself to dinner at the house of an unpopular man, and taught those who followed him not to set their hearts on material things, his followers could see what God really intended for this world. Jesus taught his followers to pray. He washed their feet. He told them to love one another. A way to live started to come into focus. When Jesus was executed, this way seemed to be crushed and powerless. But when he rose from the dead, his followers soon realized that the world was changed forever, and so were their own lives. Trying to live as they had seen Jesus lived no longer seemed beyond reach. This community still exists today. Its members speak many languages and worship in many styles. Although they belong to what appear to be many separate communities, Catholic, Presbyterian, Evangelical, Lutheran, Methodist, and many more, at the heart of all these communities is Jesus. He promised always to be with them, and they experience his presence in many ways, in the faces of people in need, in the bread they share, in the music they sing, even in the suffering they sometimes have to endure, just as he did. Sharing life with Jesus, they are caught up into the loving, challenging life of God. Christians call this life in the Holy Spirit. Jesus said, "I came that you may have life and have it abundantly." The life he offers is not just a matter of existing. It's not just eating and breathing and going with the flow. It's abundant life, life with a capital L, life full of the kind of freedom and love and courage Jesus lived himself and gave to his community. This is the bold, free life you can explore by reading this book. The authors of this book did not invent this way of living. It's thousands of years old. But we didn't find it in a museum either. People of all ages and many different cultures are living this life right now in the fast-changing world of the 21st century. Your challenge and privilege are to live it where you are, in your family, your neighborhood, your school, your world.
It's an introduction to explore with us through this book, Ways of Living. And one of the first dance steps that we explored together was engaging the story. Maggie gives a synopsis of this chapter. The Bible tells the story of God's love for us and the whole creation. When we read and study, hear and tell this story, we meet Jesus. He invites us to join the story and share God's love. The more we get into this story, the more it gets into us and shapes the way we live every day. Maggie's going to read next.
My name is Magdalena Wells, and I'm from Spokane, Washington, and I co-authored the chapters on food and story with my sister Emily and my mom Susan. This section is called Twisting the Story. One day in the summer after ninth grade, some friends and I gathered at a park to toss a frisbee, eat drippy ice cream cones, and talk. We quickly tired of playing, but none of us wanted to part and go home. So we began a discussion that drifted from topic to topic and finally settled on politics. Our debate was heated. Three people in the group strongly supported one side, and two were arguing adamantly for the other. People generally talked politely and opening at the beginning, but toward the end, harsh words were flying. Some of the words were what my mom calls Bible bullets, one-liners from the Bible hurled at someone on the other side of a disagreement. Quotations and examples flew at rocket speed, hitting me as if to say I was betraying my religion by having a particular opinion. This upset me because I knew my views were largely based on my faith, but my friends' views were based on their faith too. I admit that if I'd memorized more Bible passages, I would have shot back. But my collection was limited and irrelevant, so I lay back on the grass and waited for the ceasefire. That afternoon, my friends and I joined a long line of people who have abused the Bible's message and purpose. Throughout history, the gospel of welcome and freedom has been twisted to exclude some while lifting up others. For example, in his letter to the Romans, Paul calls for people to share the good news of Christ's love so others can hear it. This is a good thing. However, in the past, some people have read this passage very narrowly. They interpreted Paul's words, "Faith comes from what is heard," Romans 10, to mean that because deaf people cannot hear, they cannot have faith or be saved. Isn't that crazy? Paul wanted to invite more people in, but his words were used to exclude the deaf. In the same way, other passages were and are used to justify keeping slaves, beating women, killing millions of Jews in the Holocaust, exploiting creation, and shunning gays and lesbians. I live in Spokane, Washington, near a place in northern Idaho that for years was the home of the Aryan Nations. Members of this group use the Bible to support their claim that they belong to a superior race and are responsible for saving America from people of other ethnicities. However, by speaking of extremes, it's easy to brush off our own Bible abuses as small and harmless. You might consider ways you have used the Bible to hurt another, or a passage you have quoted out of context. My mom grew up with a girl who believed it was physically impossible to burn a Bible. My mom was so eager to prove this girl wrong that she scorched a few pages of her own Bible. Like my mom, we often disrespect the Bible, using it to prove a point. And like that girl, we often treat the Bible as if it were magical. We want the Bible to give us easy answers to big questions, save us from difficult situations, or show us a map of our future, magically. When we use scripture to prove ideas we already hold, or to hurt others, or to protect ourselves from the messiness of life, we are misusing it. Here's the good news. The Bible was written for more than just individuals. We interpret and understand it best in the company of others, including those we don't agree with. Maybe those people with whom we disagree challenge and stretch us the most. I'm sure my friends and I have not had our last heated debate, but if we can avoid getting too defensive, we're going to learn a lot from each other.
The next chapter that we're going to explore is called Stuff. What do we do with all that stuff that accumulates in our bedrooms and our garages and our homes? And like Maggie engaging the story and the rest of us, Alex, who co-wrote this chapter, really practiced this practice. And over Lent, for 40 days, he gave up one object of his possessions each day for 40 days, just gave it away. His room is awfully barren now. He summarizes this chapter like this. We tried to find a practice, a way of dealing with stuff, material possessions, in order to make better our relationship with God and other people. We realized that Americans have an obsession with stuff, and we tried to help you reflect on your own way of dealing with stuff. We hope this helps. Alex is going to read a section.
All right. I'm actually going to read three sections in a row, but they're short, so. Okay. A proposition. Stuff is bad when it diminishes health, love, joy, peace, hope, creative expression, faithfulness, and relationships among people and other living organisms. If I buy tennis shoes made by a 12-year-old who was paid $2 an hour and was exposed to dangerous chemicals in the process, I've bought bad stuff. When my two sons and I collect action figures from fast food meals, toys with lots of packaging, and little plastic gadgets that use up great amounts of natural resources and create greater waste for landfills, we've got bad stuff. When I buy an extra jacket just because I want two different styles, especially when others are in need of warm clothing, I've got bad stuff. Okay, next one. Even though the ways we live with and think about stuff can be damaging, God still wants us to have stuff. God gives us life and the elements in nature with which to create, enjoy, and share stuff. After all, Jesus was a carpenter, and he made stuff, so stuff can't be bad. How people relate to stuff is the problem. Focusing on material things as central to life is a constant temptation. Jesus clearly knew this when he told his followers, "You cannot serve God and wealth." Jesus believed that love of God must come first, before all our other loves, especially our love of stuff. And the last one. How can we tell the good stuff from the bad? A basic proposition. The good stuff includes those things needed to increase health, love, joy, peace, hope, creative expression, faithfulness, and relationships with people and other living organisms. Stuff is good when it helps you and the people around you become fully alive, the people God created us to be. This is the rule Jesus lived by. Jesus enjoyed and approved of all the stuff that brought life to people. Fishing nets, boats, perfume, homes, eating utensils, clothing, and cushions. Jesus Jesus appreciated those material items that deepen people's love for God, others, and themselves.
Perhaps you're getting a sense that this is a great group of people that are working on this project. The next one that we explored was a staple to life as well. It's called food. Emily summarizes this chapter. We all need to eat and drink every day. But food is more than body fuel. It is a gift from God that connects us to the earth and to the needs of others. At the table, we share food and our lives. We also thank God, welcome strangers, receive friends, and meet Jesus. Eating together, we become companions for life. Emily's going to read a section from this chapter.
My name, is Mary Emily, and I'm from Spokane, Washington. And I wrote this chapter with my sister and my mom. We are driving home, east across the state of Washington, after visiting my grandparents. My sister and I are in the back seat looking out the windows. We leave the chaos of the city, climb the pass through the Cascade Mountains, and watch in awe as the mountains give way to the rolling fields of the Columbia River Basin. As far as I can see, the land is covered in green and gold. On the side of the road are signs bearing the names of the crops: wheat, alfalfa, corn, potatoes, peas, beans, sweet onions. We count 22 crops, and those are just the ones that border the highway. I roll down my window. The hot July air rushes in, smelling of warm soil and pungent grasses. Mom passes out lunch, sandwiches and juice. Perhaps the wheat for this bread was grown in these very fields, I think, as I take a bite. How amazing that from this land, not far from my house, comes a bounty great enough to provide bread for thousands of people. More amazing yet, the contents of my sandwich come from all over the country, maybe from around the world. The tomato came from a California hothouse, the cheese from a Midwestern creamery, and the grapefruit juice from trees in Arizona or Florida. This meal, basic in content, simple in presentation, and eaten en route, not only satisfies my hunger, but also connects me to many places, people, and seasons. Being so interwoven with the whole world is one of the wonders of living in this century. However, the old saying, "With rights comes responsibility," is still true, especially in regard to food. My lunch may connect me to fields warm with sun and rich with rain, to farmers, pickers, bakers, and vendors well paid and treated fairly, and to people around the world feasting on the same goodness. But it also connects me to gross injustice and abuse. Land laden with pesticides, children laboring in fields, elders weak with hunger. The daily and necessary acts of eating and drinking bind us to both the beautiful and the broken. How do we respond to this truth as we strive to live as God's people? Our first response is gratitude. We thank God for such generous and nourishing gifts. Giving thanks opens our eyes to our connections to others. We see that we cannot thank God for the food we have and then turn our backs on those who are hungry. We cannot praise God for the bounty of the land and sea and close our eyes to the ways we abuse and pollute the soil and water. So, our second response is to extend God's generosity to all people. Extending God's generosity means actively working to restore honor and life to those people and that land burdened with the work of providing food. It means sharing our food with those who have none, being advocates for the poor, and working to change policies and systems that keep some people hungry while others have more than enough to eat. In short, giving thanks to God is more than saying grace at the table. It is living lives that reflect God's justice and love.
Next practice we explored is titled Creation. Tim wrote a summary for this. This chapter is about a practice that helps people realize how passionate you should be toward creation. The practice of caring for creation helps you understand that creation is not just scenery. You are living in creation, and your outlook on life will affect not only how you feel about creation, but how you treat it. Tim's going to read a section from this chapter.
Well, as you already heard, my name's Tim, and I am currently 16, and I live in Southern California. One thing that I did want to mention just before I read my part was that as I read this, I want you to imagine last night, looking up at the stars. I don't know if you guys all looked at the stars last night or the night before, but just kind of imagine that connection, that peace, some of the feelings that you might have felt at that particular time. This particular passage comes after a story that was actually one of Frank's stories. So I guess he might like it. But it was about him and his father, and they were kind of on a boat searching for a lost whale to try to help it out to sea. And this is part of our discussion afterwards. Here I am describing a moment that I felt in the Berkshire Hills, which are in Massachusetts. I woke up at dawn and took a solitary walk through the woods. I came upon a meadow and sat down. The woods were so still and quiet, I actually felt like I was a part of them, that the trees and the shrubs breathed the same air and shared the same ground as I. I felt reverent, as if God were present in that very moment, at the very place, and I wanted to pray. But I didn't need to find a prayer to say. The silent sense of being at one with the woods was prayer itself.
Next chapter, we'll explore the next dance step that we played around with is called play. Jack describes this chapter this way. Sports can be playful, but free, unstructured play is even more important than sports. Playing frees our minds and bodies and helps us deal with the demands and restrictions of everyday living. Playing helps us see and do things in new ways. Besides that, it's fun to play. Don wrote this chapter with Jack, and Jack is a tennis player and was not able to be here today, but Don is going to read part of this Jack
was actually just playing in the Super National Hardcore Tournament in Kalamazoo. He's a very fine player, and we had a great time working on this chapter together on the play. I'm Don Richter, and I'm from Asheville, North Carolina, also known as the freak capital of the United States. I'm sure glad computers come with reset buttons. Ever had a computer lock up on you? Perhaps you're running one program too many and suddenly, wonk, the screen freezes, the keyboard stalls. You can't even run the standard shutdown operation with your mouse. What do you do besides panic that you might lose that important paper you're writing? You push the reset button and hold your breath until your system reboots and gives you options for retrieving your documents. Well, here's some good news. Play is the reset button God gives us to get a fresh take on a situation and to renew our lives. Sure, life is more than a game. Yet, even when times are difficult and tense, people who know how to play can envision new possibilities. A playful spirit knows how to improvise, how to juggle, how to think outside of the box. A playful mind knows how to combine things that don't ordinarily belong together. How to wonder about different ways to do something, including ways that might seem silly or improbable at first. Some business consultants actually make their clients play with children's toys, so they'll also start playing with ideas for new products. Think about it.
This group did play together, too. You can know that you can't play Capture the Flag in the middle of a downtown hotel in Chicago. The next chapter, the next segment of life we explored is time. And Martha said it all in her synopsis. Teenagers often have strict schedules. In a society that is constantly telling us to do so many things, it is often hard to find time for God and time for the rest we need. This chapter is about taking regular moments to be instead of to do. If we learn this Christian practice, we can recognize the true value of time and notice the blessings God puts in our lives every day. John, who also co-wrote this chapter, is going to read a section.
Hi, I'm John. I'm 16 now. I wrote this chapter with my mom and Martha, my twin sister. It's about time. It is the first day of high school, and the assistant principal is delivering some stiff instruction to John and Martha's freshman class. All students must be in their first period classroom by 7:35 a.m. You have 5 minutes to change classes between periods. You'll get a warning the first time you are not in your seat when the bell rings. The second time, you get a detention. Always carry your school schedule book. Use it to keep track of homework assignments, after-school practices, exam dates, and application deadlines. You cannot have a pass to the bathroom unless you have your schedule book with you. John, who is definitely not a morning person, is worried. He doubts whether he can race from one wing of the high school to another in only 5 minutes, especially if he needs to get something from his locker between classes. He wonders whether he'll be able to keep track of all his books and papers and get everything done on time. When he got home that day, John sat down with me and reflected. It's a pretty dramatic change from waking up in the calm environment of my bedroom to finding myself among hundreds of people chattering and running, just barely making it to class. From an environment where time doesn't matter to a place where time controls you, and missing the schedule could get you a detention. One thing school does, I have come to realize, is train me to live a basic lifestyle that will exist throughout my life. That lifestyle must be centered around time. Rules about time shape the life of every high school student, and rules about time will shape your whole life. These rules determine how fast things move, how much people try to get done each day, as well as how much unstructured time they have, how often they stop working to eat, chat with friends, sleep, or just plain think. Choices in all these areas affect the quality of a person's life. So, it's important to live in time in a way that results in a high quality life. John talked about a lifestyle that must be centered around time. What he really needs, what all of us need, is to move from that mindset to a different perspective. We need a way to live well in time. We need a design for our time that allows us to know and enjoy God, ourselves, and other people. Christian practices can help us to learn this kind of design. No matter how many rules other people set for your life, God wants you to take a non-active period, a nap, a time to rest, a time to be with God, a time to let down your guard and just be. This chapter starts with the time pressure teams face today, but by the end, we'll all be sharing a nap.
The next practice that we explore together is written up in a chapter called Welcome. And Caitlin summarized this chapter like this. We usually think of welcoming as greeting someone we know with hospitality. In these significant years of our lives, it means a lot more. It means opening our hearts to all people and accepting them as equal children of God. I welcome you into our chapter, and I hope you find the strength to pursue this promising practice. Martha's going to read an excerpt from this.
Hi, I'm Martha, and I helped to write the time and life chapters with my mother and brother. In 1988, I was welcomed to South Africa at a time when that nation suffered under the stranglehold of racial separation and hatred, known as apartheid. Whites controlled the country while blacks lived in utter poverty. Those who joined the anti-apartheid struggle for freedom were arrested and imprisoned, some killed. I had gone to South Africa as a journalist with Sojourners magazine in an effort to help tell the rest of the world the truth about what was going on there. Jam Jam, a young man active in the freedom struggle, welcomed me, a total stranger, at great risk to himself. He had just been released after 10 months in prison, where he had been kept in a cold cell, fed only cornmeal infested with worms, and tortured. He showed me around the black township where he and other blacks were forced to live. Before long, a Caspier, an armored personnel carrier, appeared, and 8 members of the South African army jumped out and surrounded us, pointing rifles. We were interrogated by an officer of the security police. The officer angrily threatened to put Jam Jam back into prison because Jam Jam knew that it was illegal for a white person to be in a black area, yet he was showing me around. I will never forget what happened next. In response to the threats, Jam Jam reached calmly into his back pocket and took out his small New Testament. Putting it right up to the face of the angry officer, he said simply, "Sir, I am a Christian." The officer, confronted with the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ, had nothing to say. He let us go. Today, apartheid no longer exists in South Africa. In 1994, Nelson Mandela became that country's first black president after spending 29 years in prison for his anti-apartheid activities. South Africa has been transformed, in large part because of the courage of faithful Christians like Jam Jam, who held on to a vision of South Africa where blacks and whites could live peacefully, welcoming one another as equals, as people created and loved by the same God. They drew their courage from Jesus Christ, who taught them to love their enemies, who welcomed everyone into his community of followers, who welcomes each of us now.
The next dimension of life that we explore together is music. Liz summarized this chapter like this. Music isn't some shrink-wrapped product you buy at the store. Music is a human thing,
a body thing and a spirit thing. You don't have to play a musical instrument to join in the practice of making music. Simply listening to music or singing along with your friends is a way of sounding your life. Music is an incredible universal language, truly a gift from God. Sometimes when I'm moving to music, it is as if time stands still. I'm so focused, so caught in the moment, that the stresses of life and school just seem to disappear. I literally feel one with the universe. Susan's going to read the section.
My name is Susan Breland. I co-authored with Magdalena and Mary Emily Food and Story, but I read from the music chapter written by Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls, Don Saliers, her father, Mark Monk Winstanley, a grown-up, full-fledged adult, and Liz Marshburn, a world-class gymnast. I chose this section because of the meteors. Scientists once believed the smallest particle in the universe were atoms. Then they discovered electrons and protons. Then came quarks. Now scientists have discovered components they call strings. Strings are like tiny pieces of spaghetti, but millions of times smaller. They vibrate like strings on a violin or guitar, but at a fantastically high frequency. If the scientists are right, the most fundamental particle in the universe is a vibrating string. Think of it. This discovery offers a new way of understanding a very old idea. The whole creation is singing to God.
The last chapter excerpt we're going to share with you comes from the last chapter of the book called Prayer. And Alex summarized this chapter. Praying is about opening yourself up to God. People pray in some form when they have wants or are thankful. But this chapter says that prayer can also be a way of life. If we can see and practice prayer everywhere in our lives, we can be constantly in touch with God and always feel God's love. Mark's going to read next week.
I'm Mark Iaconelli. I live in San Anselmo, California, where also counselors as well. We work on this together. As a child, I thought prayer concerned only my wants. Every night at bedtime, I would present God with a long list. Dear Lord, please let it snow tomorrow. Let Dad come home early from work. Please don't let me have too much homework. And please smite Jeff and all his future offspring for breaking my bike. In Jesus' name, amen. I seem to think God was a giant genie in the sky and prayers were magic wishes. By observing my parents and others at church, I learned some of the tricks to make the magic work. You had to close your eyes and not peek. You couldn't smile or giggle. You had to start with Dear Lord, and you had to end with In Jesus' Name. I learned that God could be touchy. Prayers had to be polite and formal. You had to say thank you and give lots of compliments. God, you're looking so mighty today. You had to use all the right titles, Jehovah, Creator, Your Royal Godness. You also had to be careful not to get too pushy. It was best to pretend like what you really wanted didn't matter. The trick was to ask first for all the things God wanted before mentioning what you really wanted. God, help me to be good, help me to be kind, help me to be loving, and oh yeah, as if you didn't care, please find some way to get me the new Star Master 3 video laser adapter, not the generic laser adapter, but the really cool Star Master 3, and let there be peace on earth, in Jesus' name, amen. Clearly the best prayers were by people with deep voices who spoke God's special and unique if language. O God of Zion, thanketh thee for us, this is death. Granteth that we mayeth be worthy of thy, this is the part where I usually fell asleep. Unfortunately, I could never get the magic to work. Many of my prayers were not answered. God never smote my neighbor Jeff, who grew up, got married, and has lots of children. I couldn't understand why I should pray. What was the point of bringing my wants to God if God never met them?
Well, these are little tastes of the stories and stumblings and insights we've gathered as we journeyed together for these 3 years on trying to find a way to live in the midst of our world. And we'd like to take a few minutes to hear any of your own insights, your own stumblings, your own questions about a way of living in the world or how we've been engaging in it ourselves. So, please, yeah.
What was the proof text on cushions?
Jesus puts his hand on a cushion in the boat in the midst of the storm.
Frederick Buechner.
Bible bullet.
Frederick Buechner writes a wonderful thing. He said, I would long to have been that cushion.
I'd like to ask young people, thank you, first of all, thank you for all of your work in this. I'd like to ask you some of the ways that you imagine those of us who are active in our parishes, I happen to be a pastor, different ways you imagine us using this resource with young people in our parish.
There's going to be a leader's guide online, and there's a website, www.waytolive.org, and it just went live a week ago. And we imagine that youth groups might read through chapters and discuss them. Every chapter has 5 things to do, 5 active ways to get involved, different things to think about that relate to that practice. There's also a lot of other things to do on the website. So we imagine that people might go through them practice by practice, or maybe discover and research and write up another practice. We realized as we were writing this that there aren't just 18. There are a lot of others that we would have loved to add. But this is, you know, this is one book. So we just hope it'll be a great conversation starter, and not just a conversation starter, something that will actually launch teens and adults into a new life-giving kind of life.
So you imagine it being used with like teen adult groups?
Yeah.
Not necessarily exclusively.
Right. You know.
I think the beauty of this project was the mentoring relationships, that the way it worked out with a youth and adult connected together.
Yeah, the book I wanted to write at the end of this was what happened to all of us in doing this for 3 years. And we actually talked about that what we really wanted to do was inspire churches to get together and write their own book just so they could go through this process together, because it was really inspiring towards the end of the project where, you know, we had 18 adults, at least 16 of those, I think, have PhDs. So they're very disabled. So we had those people and we had these teens, and we're bringing in writing together, and by the end of the 3 years, you couldn't tell the difference. We would have heated debates about some of these chapters, and everyone's voice was really taken, and I've never seen that in all my work in youth ministry. I've never seen that happen before, where the lines really fell apart and we were all talking about what how we live with stuff, how much material goods is right and what's not, and trying to figure that out together.
You mentioned, Maggie, a website. If kids, in responding to what they've read, want to get in touch with an author of a particular section, is there going to be a link? Or are you open to email, you know, email links? Or have you talked about that?
What does it say? What is the language on the site?
There's no link now to the authors, but there is a place for feedback. Okay. And so, you know, if you have a question or something, there's a way you could send that question, and we'll be glad to try to forward that on. Okay. I can't promise, because there's a much larger group of people, so we can't promise that everybody, like, you know, Emily Saliers, she's on tour right now in Europe, so I can't promise, you know, she'll be able to answer questions. But yeah, we'll do our best to try to relay those questions. The site, there's actually right now a preview site that's up. It's just a static page. The real site's going to go live in, by the end of the month here.
Oh.
And it has, well, you've seen the beta site. It was tested.
But I thought you said it was going to go up while we were up here.
Well, we thought it might, but we're going to wait till we get back to launch it. But it's another whole way of looking at these, because they're, it's an acting group. We hired a professional playwright to work with us, and they actually do little scenarios with each other on each of these practices. It's a very dynamic way to engage it. It's not just presenting information. It's very interactive. Again, like watching little episodes on these different practices.
And it can kind of stand alone too, so if you've got teens that won't be interested in the book, they
might be interested. Can use that.
Sir, okay. One last comment or
I'm just kind of curious how, I mean, you said 3 years you were together. I assume that wasn't like constant. Did you meet once every quarter, or how did that work?
We met four times over the course of the 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So every about 5-6 months in between, where we practicing them and researching them and writing drafts of the chapters, and then got together and looked at each other's drafts. But also we didn't just research and talk. We also prayed together every time we gathered. We played together. We ate together. We looked at the communities that we were in together. So it was a whole process.
And meeting in twos at home.
And meeting in twos at home with the people who are writing books together.
I found as an adult involved in this process that this kind of reflection with young people can be very stimulating to one's own faith as well. So it's about helping youth to grow in faith, but it's also giving adults an opportunity to get out of our boxes and really hear the urgent questions and hope and faith and help that young people bring to the church.
Okay. One last question we got.
I'm just kind of curious. You said that you met four times over 3 years, and it sounds like it was just incredible for you guys to get together with the youth and the adults. But I am curious about the youth that participated in this. What is their socioeconomic background? Are they all, more middle class, or did you get any input from some of the lower income church areas, Lutheran church areas?
It would be true that most are from middle class. However, what we did was invite 18 adults who represent different parts of the church. So, for instance, there are two Christian Methodist Episcopal women pastors in this group, for example. And hope that each adult would bring youth that they could work with themselves. It would be a contribution to their communities. So, because the adults are well-educated, that there's some class distinction, but there is some attention to that. That's a dynamic that we sought to address, and I'm sure not adequately.
More racial diversity than class diversity. But that's an issue that we had on the table always, and even what kind of book we were going to produce, the issue of who would be the audience for this book.
I think one objective, I think, of the book was to kind of show like the net of the different practices, the things that really made up teen life, not necessarily looking at ethnical backgrounds or looking at economical backgrounds, but to really deal with the person, their yearning for God, and their yearning and their passions, to allow their passions to really come out and to be experienced. A lot of times, media or however things come about, people crush the passions of teens, or they don't see them, or they just say, oh, they're just one of those teens that do their own thing. We really want to empower teens, whether they're going through emotional, troubles or whatever, So we really stressed to try to reach teens at different levels. Just a general way.
How do you plan on getting the book to those people that can't economically get to that level?
We have not really addressed that issue yet. I've thought about it, but we're still planning. We still have tons of things to talk about. The book just kind of came up now, so we're just thinking about it.
It's the role of the church.
Yeah, a lot of stuff is being passed through the church right now. And that's all I'm aware of.
Well, I'm mindful of the time, and wanted to kind of wrap this up for now, but this conversation I hope will go on. But I hope you've heard that this was an extraordinary process for us, and the biggest value is not to read this book. What we really hope that people would do would be to participate in a very similar kind of process, because it really was an extraordinary, very mutual, mutually transforming project. But we do have a book. We hope people will read it. And not only do we have one, but we have a sale going on for this week only, where you can get this $16 book for only $10. And even more, you can get it autographed in the next hour. The teens and adults who are here are going to go over towards the bookstore and have a little autograph party. So if you'd like to purchase a copy of this book at a discount price, come on over and join us. We would love that. But
did I miss your drumming?
No, that's where we're coming in right now. Because really what we, even more than you buying this book, we want to invite you into the journey that we've been fortunate enough to be engaging on together. And that is, we began with drumming. We began listening for that beat that pulsates deep at the heart of creation. We listened for that dance. And we were surprised, relieved, gladdened to know that there is a music. There is that pulse beat that we can move to. And in moving to this beat and this rhythm, sometimes we stumble, but it does give rise to life. And we would like to close with joining together in moving and stepping to some of the beat that we are discovering along the way.
So here's what we're going to do. This is going to be just like trying to live these practices. In other words, it's going to be very, there's going to be a lot of stumbling and awkwardness and mistakes and problems. But man, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. So, because we've never practiced drumming other than once 3 years ago. So what we're gonna do is, I think in our first original drum circle, Tim started the beat. And so we'll have Tim start, and then the rest of us are gonna kind of join in. Does everybody have something? And this is a free drum too. And then I'm going to lead us over to the bookstore, and those of you who don't want to, just sneak out or pretend like you have to go to the bathroom or whatever. What I'm going to do is start the dance. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to come around here, and I'm going to dance over here. I'm going to grab some of you, and we're going to do a conga line. So you'll just put your hands on my shoulders, and we'll dance out of this room. And there's going to be chairs, and it's going to be hard to get together and hard to do it together. And that's what practices are, and that's how difficult it is to do the dance. But something will work. Okay, so Tim, start us off.